Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From seven- and eight-figure bonuses to a $700 billion bailout, Congress and the Bush administration are rushing to rescue a financial system on the brink of collapse. American taxpayers brace for the bill. Wall Street's Gilded Age may be over. The last two big investment banks standing, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, running for cover. But in the bailout, what future will be drawn? Who wins? Who loses this time? And what new vision gets the nod? This hour, On Point Public, bailout for Wall Street and the shape of the rescue. You can join the conversation. What should the mega bailout of America's financial system mean for Wall Street and the rest of the country? Are we socializing the losses after 30-plus years of hyper-wealth and private gain? Joining me now from New York is Dennis Berman, editor and reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He writes the paper's Deal Journal blog. Mr. Berman, thanks for being here.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So, first of all, what seems to be emerging in Washington? Nobody knows the final shape of it yet, but is Wall Street still comforted? Does it still look as though it's going to work for the street?
Well, it's certainly better than it was before, and the before scenario was rather drastic. You basically had situations where the existence of the two last independent banks, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, was under fire. So there's going to be a lot of horse trading and a lot of political rhetoric as this enters the D.C. Beltway zone. That's going to be unpleasant in its own right. But from Wall Street's perspective, it's certainly a better alternative than what was happening before.
What does it mean that Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley will leave their status as investment banks and become more like commercial banks?
I mean, I think people on Wall Street and people who cover it, like us here at the Journal, we sort of understand these things instinctually. But basically anyone outside of probably a 10-block radius in New York has no idea what this means. So I'll try to be as simple as I can.
Mm-hmm.
What it means is that investment banks were riskier institutions. They could borrow more money and make riskier bets. Now, and they were regulated by the SEC. What's now changed is that they're going to be, at least they say, nominally, less risky institutions, taking on less leverage to make their bets, and regulated by the Fed in the same way the Fed regulates your J.P. Morgan branch down the road or your small community bank down the road. They're going to submit themselves to the same oversight. And this has big repercussions sort of throughout the financial system. So it may seem arcane, but it's actually quite important.
It doesn't seem arcane to me. Does it mean that Wall Street, as we've known it and understood its character, its nature, even its function, is over? Can that be?
Yes.
Yes. So
what's remarkable is that it's happened in about a week's time. Now, you could say that the end result here is that it's been a week, but it's really something that's been building over the course of the last decade. And you can put a lot of blame on a lot of different characters and actors here. But Wall Street was able to grow its balance sheets and able to grow the borrowing it was taking on, largely because of bigger changes in the global financial system. Money was flowing over from Asia and from Europe that was going into the U.S. Treasury. Treasury kept rates pretty low, and we were all, as a country, able to enjoy in the, frankly, the vast overborrowing that the rest of the world permitted us to take on. And now that is coming to an end.
But if something fundamental in the nature of Wall Street is changing, what does it look like on the other side? Wall Street prided itself on a kind of American model, very aggressive, lots and lots of borrowing, leverage, big deals, fast deals, mega million-dollar bonuses. Is that history? Is that just tamped down a little bit? What are people expecting?
Well, here's my perspective, and I think it's probably more important to take it from the Main Street point of view first than the Wall Street point of view. The Main Street point of view is the following, is that we've been gorging on debt as a country, individually, as corporations, as a government. That debt is going to be not available to us anymore, and that means that the standard of living that we've been able to achieve, be it our houses, our cars, our college educations, our public works, all those things, that standard of living is going to come down. And I don't think that necessarily Washington wants to make that point to the country, but that's what's going to happen. Less credit, and we're going to have to work harder to pay back the debts that we have. For that, Wall Street, it means less risky culture, which means less growth, less capital coursing through the system, and all the people who took their bites of the apple as the cash went around, be it the bankers making $10 million, the traders making $500 billion, all that's going to be tamped down a bit. I do think that, you know, as we're here in the heat of the moment, mm-hmm. and we're saying Wall Street's over, Wall Street's over. But there's, of course, an entrepreneurial adaptive spirit in this country. So 5 years from now, Wall Street won't be the same, but I can imagine there'll be other institutions, other vehicles that sort of spring up in its absence that do take on some of the functions.
And when it comes to Hank Paulson's big bailout, $700 billion or whatever it ends up being, we read now that big financiers, that means Wall Street, are lobbying to have it extended beyond just bad mortgage debt to other kinds of debt, maybe credit card debt, car loans. Do you hear that lobbying going on, that cry?
Well, I think it's going to be quite a political battle, especially with an election just a few weeks away. So I can't forecast what that's going to look like. But rule one of Wall Street trading, always ask for more than you think you're going to get. I think that's what's occurring right now. So I imagine it'll be pretty hard for them to slough off credit card debt and auto loans. It's probably going to be pretty directly mortgage-related by the time it's over.
Dennis Berman with the Wall Street Journal writes the paper's Deal Journal blog out of New York. Dennis, thank you very much for being with us.
Yep, thanks.
In his appearance yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson said a terrible chain reaction is crippling the economy. He said that's what's forced him to propose massive government intervention in the financial markets.
This is not something that we wanted to do. This is something that is very necessary. We've had excesses building up for some time in this country. They played out first in terms of bad lending practices, irresponsible borrowing, irresponsible lending. It then moved a chain reaction into the financial institutions, illiquid assets. That then is played out into the broader economy. Last week, there were times when the capital markets, the credit markets were frozen.
Frozen capital markets, credit markets, and that means trouble for the American economy and others as well. Maybe this bailout will change it. Its scale is unprecedented if it goes through on the scale that Hank Paulson's talking about. To help us look at it, the vision behind this bailout, the shape of the rescue, and what it might mean for the economy ahead, I'm joined right now, first in the studio, by Kenneth Rogoff. He's professor of economics at Harvard University, chief economist and director of research at the International Monetary Fund, formerly. Kenneth Rogoff, Professor Rogoff, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us from Austin, Texas, James K. Galbraith, professor of government and business relations at the University of Texas at Austin, author of, formerly executive director of the Joint Economic Committee for the U.S. Congress, author of the new book, The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. James Galbraith, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
What do you see unfolding in Hank Paulson's plan? We're being told, you know, by all the great figures of the administration and no small number in Congress, this is necessary, this is vital, and we need to do it just as quickly and cleanly, in Hank Paulson's words, as possible. How do you see it?
Well, I would say that the ball is in the court of Congress, and it is up to Congress to write a law which meets the crisis but also defends the public interest and the national interest. And there are a great many things about this. Well, there's some things in particular about this bill. It is written to be completely unaccountable and unreviewable, which will be unacceptable to Congress and will have to be changed in the drafting process over the next few days. That's the first, I think, important point. A second important point is that Congress is going to be interested in seeing that other conditions are imposed on the bill, relief for homeowners. There's talk about limits on the compensation of Wall Street executives. These things will be argued over, and what will happen ultimately is unclear, but it's important to recognize that Congress has its own imperatives in this matter. And this thing were to dissolve in scandal, which is possible, the people who enacted those laws would be blamed. So they've got to Their concerns which are being articulated yesterday and today, I think have to be taken seriously, and we'll see where we end up in a week's time.
Kenneth Rogoff, Hank Paulson said he wants a bill that is clean and spare, not a lot added to it, but James Galbraith is describing it as, you know, not having the kind of fundamental protections that the public interest might require here. How much time, given the way that world financial markets were responding last week before word of this came out, how much time and leeway do you see the Congress is having to tinker with this before we're back in that kind of crisis mode, or are we still there?
Well, I think there is time, in fact. I think the critical thing that they did last week was showing that the government's going to come in. The government, you don't have to worry about your money market fund, your savings bank. I can't tell you how many people I've met who said they're withdrawing all their money from the bank or from their money market fund. That is just going on all over the economy. They had to put a stop to that. That was really leading to a crash. This has stopped that. But there's a question of how to reorganize the whole thing, and it's hard to do quickly.
Can it be done in time to be both responsible and effective for staunching a further credit freeze, a further kind of panic?
Well, I think it can. I mean, setting aside the political process, our banking system's bloated. It's too big. They were raking in 30% of corporate profits the last few years, 10% of wages, this tiny sector. Mm-hmm. It had gotten too big. It needs to shrink. And the big question in the proposal is how much money are they actually going to give to the financial sector for these junk assets that they're buying? How much of a transfer is there's going to be? If it's big, that'll keep it afloat a little while longer, but it won't solve the underlying problem that it needs to shrink. Does Congress, does the administration have the vision to let the system shrink as it needs to?
We'll come back and look at the shape of the rescue and the economy on the other side of it. Kenneth Rogoff, please stand by, and James Galbraith in Austin, Texas. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the super bailout of America's financial system, what it would mean, how it might be shaped, who it will really help. I'm joined today in the studio by Kenneth Rogoff, professor of economics at Harvard University, and James K. Galbraith from Austin, Texas, with us, professor at the University of Texas at Austin, author of the new book, The Predator State. Not everybody's happy with this package. On CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama, a top Republican on the Senate Banking Committee, said he's not convinced the proposed bailout will stop the financial meltdown.
We don't know the end game in this, and I'll tell you what bothers me about this, that I believe that the chairman of the Fed and the Treasury Secretary Paulson, with all due respect to them, they've been staggering from crisis to crisis, and they haven't even said today that this will end the crisis.
Jamie Galbraith in Austin, Texas, will go to how it might be shaped and what the implications are, depending how it's shaped, but what about its fundamental effectiveness? Will this do it?
Well, I don't think we know that. With regard to what Senator Shelby said, those who built their career on the mythology of the free market and the idea of deregulation and the idea that you could run a financial system by fundamentally looking the other way are going to have a lot of problem with this. This puts an end, I think, to that notion. It makes it clear that a financial system has to be regulated by an autonomous authority that takes the job of regulation seriously. The responsibility for this really does lie with an enormous amount of regulatory malfeasance leading to abusive financial practices in the extension of subprime mortgages in the last 4 or 5 years. That's where the primary fault lies. That model is over. What we're going to end up with down the road is a set of financial institutions that are primarily banks, that are regulated, that are substantially less buccaneering than the independent Wall Street firms have been, substantially less profitable. I think that's very likely to prove to be a good thing for the economy, enable us to get back to business, get back to to economic activity that's actually productive, and that's more sustainable and more stable. At least I think that is the upside on all of this.
Ken Rogoff, same question to you on the likely effectiveness, first of all, of this bailout if it comes to pass at the scale we're talking about, $700 billion or a trillion. And do you agree with James Galbraith that the sort of, open-ended, free market, buccaneering era of U.S. economy is over, is ending?
Well, let me start with the second question first. I mean, we certainly need better updated regulation. There's been incredible innovation in the financial sector. Regulation hasn't kept up with it. But I think it would be a terrible mistake to throw out the baby with the bathwater. The financial sector is the flagship sector of the U.S. economy.
That sentence sounds strange today. I have to say, it sounds very strange today.
We've had 25 spectacular years where the United States has had very low interest rates, tremendous stability. Our financial sector has probably allowed the United States to pay $100 to $300 billion less in interest payments to the rest of the world. The rest of the world has been taking a lot of the hit on this. Of course, there was regulatory malfeasance. Of course, there are tons of characters to blame for what's happening. But I think we have to be careful not to overshoot and turn into France rather than a better version of the United States.
James Galbraith, is that where we're headed? Are we turning into France? And do you
see the French caricature always comes up in all of this? And it really is very, very beside the point. The problem here is that the financial sector has poisoned the well. It has created a condition where the past is the past. The future cannot be like the past because no one believes there is no trust left in the system. To restore trust, you're going to have not only a new, perhaps new regulatory powers, but new personnel, funds for enforcement. You're going to have to go in and look at the fraud and abuse, and you're going to have to prosecute where appropriate. You're going to have an entirely new philosophy of government. I'm not saying overshooting, but this has got to be major change. As for the financial sector being the leading sector, you know, frankly, I don't buy it. I think technology has been the leading sector, has been the capacity for technological change, which is unique in this country, has been our major calling card and selling point with the world. That we still have. We can apply that capacity in other areas. We need to apply it in energy. We need to deal with climate change. If we do that, the world will continue to be willing to lend to us into the future. And I don't think we're going to get away from borrowing from the rest of the world. But the fact is that we have a government which remains the world's best borrower and can borrow on the best terms, the longest maturities. That's a good sign about the creditworthiness of the country as a whole. So we deal with this problem going forward. The underlying economy, I think, is essentially unimpaired.
But Ken Rogoff is saying if you take away that freedom that the Buccaneers had, that they've sort of driven off the edge of the world here, but if you take it away, we'll be in big trouble somehow.
We are in big trouble. We're in big trouble because of the abuses that have already occurred. These need to be dealt with in a way which is credible to the rest of the world. If we simply say, you know, we're going to go back and restore the conditions of a year or two ago, you know, then we will end up essentially viewed as a bad credit risk by the rest of the world. We have to take the problem seriously and deal with the underlying causes of it seriously. That's not going to be done in this bill, but it certainly will be the agenda over the next year or so in Congress.
Ken Rogoff, where would you be steering? To a year or two ago or to some place, some spot fundamentally new in terms of the balance of regulation and market freedom?
Oh, fundamentally new, certainly. We need to have banks have more of their own cash in their deals, higher capital requirements is the jargon. Mm-hmm. We need to have regulations which make it more difficult to pile up these bets which nobody understands. And when they go wrong, nobody can unwind them. I want to pick up on the example of the tech sector. We had a meltdown in the tech sector at the beginning of this century.
The internet bust.
Complete collapse. Mm-hmm. But we didn't go in and regulate it out of business. We let businesses fail. We let the firms go under. And now the tech sector, again, is the envy of the world. It's regenerated itself.
But we're not doing that here with the financial sector. Should we be? Should more of these firms be going under?
Well, that's absolutely the point, Tom. I think the best form of regulation, yes, we need better government regulation, but the best form of regulation in finance involves self-regulation, where CEOs think they won't get paid, equity holders think they'll lose their money, people who lend to these firms think they'll lose their money. And if we go around and bail them out too richly, they think, heh, you know, we can
what
just
the heck?
Keep doing things.
But aren't we drowning that dynamic right now in all this talk of hundreds of billions, maybe $1 trillion?
Well,
self-regulation, I think, is utterly illusory. One of the things that happened last week is that Secretary Paulson and Chairman Bernanke took a last stand on the basically last stand of market discipline, and they told Lehman Brothers that it had to go bankrupt. Basically, it wasn't going to get a bailout. That they basically were drawing the line, saying no bailouts. Well, it turned out Lehman Brothers had exposure to counterparties, which led to catastrophic dangers, a panic attack on Wall Street. And within a couple of days, Paulson and Bernanke were back, and they were bailing out AIG. So the strategy with a small number of large financial firms, all of them deeply intertwined in this way, which is a Gordian knot that no one can untangle, and Ken has already described that very accurately, means that, in effect, there is no alternative to having an effective regulatory system. And some of that's got to be in this bill. The Treasury's got to be able to know what these firms are doing, what's in their portfolios, what their proprietary models are. It's got to have very strong protections against conflict of interest, against cronyism. The Congress has got to be able to see through to the Treasury and what the Treasury's doing in all of this.
I think none of that is in this bill right now, is it?
Real control over fraud. Anti-fraud mechanisms need to be put in place. In other words, confidence needs to be restored in all kinds of ways, which are going to require a lot of attention to detail.
But is any of that in what's been rolled out so far by Hank Paulson?
No, none of it. But believe me, the Congress has got a role to play in drafting legislative provisions that deal with these issues.
Have we already rolled past that moment of self-regulation? Does the fact that this bailout is on the table mean that the self-regulation you would like to see take place is already moot?
Well, no. I mean, we're talking about how the system's going to regenerate itself. The system is collapsing. It's shrinking. But I think we're kidding ourselves if we think that we can have the government run the financial sector. It's just way too complicated. There's been tremendous innovation. That innovation's not going to go away. If this is an industry that finance and insurance accounts for 8% of our GDP, you want to let it go, China will happily take it up in 10 or 15, 10 or 20 years when they're ready. The rest of the world will step in. This has been the envy of the rest of the world. Yes, less so now, but everyone's looking at what can we do to get a piece of this. How can we take this from the U.S.? And absolutely, we need better regulation, more capital requirements. Banks have to have more of their own money. They have to trade more market-oriented instruments so we can unwind these things without bringing the government in. We need globally integrated regulation. But I don't think we want to have the government try to figure out what these guys can trade. It's just too complicated.
I want to begin to hear from our listeners, Charlie in Sumter, South Carolina. Charlie, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. The balance sheets of the companies, the banks that are getting this bailout, the impact on the world economy of the American financial system, if you roll all those things together, It looks like they're either filing for bankruptcy in some cases or getting a debt consolidation loan, something on that line.
Mm-hmm.
If that is indeed true, then how is it so different from the consumer who took a bad mortgage, didn't pay it off correctly, or they got themselves over their head in credit card debt,
right,
and worked their way out through a debt consolidation loan or something like that? If all those are true, how is it different, number one? Number two, is the Paulson plan going to have enough teeth in it to keep these folks from doing this all over again, and these CEOs that pulled away multi-million dollar payoffs from getting it, maybe taking a cut of pay now, but in 2 or 3 to 5 years, doing it all over again?
Charlie?
At the moment, the bill has no safeguards in it at all. The Treasury sent over a document which actually said that the actions that they would take under the bill would not be subject to review by any court or any agency. Congress isn't going to accept that. I don't think it's constitutional to begin with. So the question of what kind of teeth will be put into this is a very open one. And the question you raise about executive compensation is being raised on the Hill, because precisely there is a danger that if you simply shovel cash into these companies, which are desperate for it, that the chief executives may take a bonus, a severance package, and walk. And there's nothing to stop them from doing that unless you put something in it to stop them from doing it. And then again, you have the question of, are they going to be willing to work if their compensation is curtailed? So that's a thorny issue, but it's not one that can be dismissed, because it gets to the heart of the question as it's seen by many people out there in the public who are going to be voting on the for their representatives and senators in just a few days.
Ken Galbraith, I'm sorry, Ken Rogoff says, Jamie Galbraith, that on the other side of this, you've got to still have some freedom in there, and you can't have government running the financial sector, or it won't exist here. It'll be off in China or somewhere else. How do you get in there?
I have some experience in China. I served as their chief technical advisor for macroeconomic reform for some years in the 1990s. There is no way the Chinese financial sector is going to compete with ours under any conceivable scenario. And one of the reasons is the Chinese government's terrified of the financial sector and the potential instability that it can bring. So it keeps it pretty tightly under under control and reacts when it gets as the speculative excesses get too large. But in any event, it's a very primitive sector by comparison to ours and doesn't pose a competitive threat in any sense of the term. I don't think the government's going to get into the business of regulating the financial sector, of running the financial sector. But the regulatory structure does have to be considerably stricter than it has been. We have a system here in which enormous assets, which have been created in over-the-counter markets, which cannot be traded at all because they cannot be priced. This is the big question that's facing the bailout, is exactly what value do you offer for these assets? There is no market for them. That's a problem which I think would not have arisen under an effective regulatory scheme. You need to have liquid markets.
I think that's a problem that could be addressed.
We don't have.
Ken Rogoff, you hear in our caller's question, the sense of where's the equity here? American consumers all over the country go bankrupt. Bankruptcy laws have been tightened. There's pretty tough teeth in there, and they're required to step up. There's no bailout for them. So here we've got taxpayers in their millions, in effect, bailing out a sector that drove itself right off the edge.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't say that the financial sector exactly has remained unscathed. The investment banks, the five big investment banks, were the symbols of our financial sector. They're all gone today. There's not a single one going to be standing at the end of this. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, the last two not to go under, their stock prices have fallen so much they've been forced to become commercial banks. If you look at what happened to AIG, that's the big insurance company, people say that was bailed out. The equity holders have basically been cleaned out. I mean, I think Paulson and Bernanke have actually been pretty tough. It remains to be seen in this $700 billion what price they're going to give for the
junk
bonds.
Assets. Mm-hmm.
And I want to come back to, does the rest of the world want this? Yes, China's a ways down, but there's Singapore, there's Hong Kong, there is Europe. There are many places in the world striving to take some of this business. It indeed will evaporate if you overregulate it. Now, you can say, well, we're not going to overregulate it. It is very difficult balance to strike. I think what's actually happened of having the investment banks pulled into commercial banks, that brings them into the regulatory oversight. Mm-hmm. That's a giant step that's taken place already. That is really humbling for these guys.
Simple question then on executive compensation. If Wall Street compensation gets regulated by Congress, is that, to your mind, too much regulation? We've all seen these gigantic packages and the skewing of American income and wealth that's happened in the last 20 years.
You know, I actually favor doing something on that score, at the very least having compensation be deferred and contingent on long-term returns and not short-term returns. But there's certainly a case for looking at this. If the banks and the investment banks want to get bailed out, they want taxpayer money, that's a completely legitimate question. But again, you don't want to push it too far. It's a big world market out there, and we want to be competitive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the super bailout of America's financial system, what it means, how it may be shaped, who it really helps, and how. Kenneth Rogoff is with us from Harvard University and James Galbraith from the University of Texas at Austin, author of the new book, The Predator State. Ken Rogoff, what about paying for all this? I'm looking here at numbers out today at thinkprogress.org. It's affiliated with the Center for American Progress. In 2007, Wall Street's five biggest firms, Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, paid a record $39 billion in bonuses to themselves. That's a year when they lost $74 billion in stock declines, their worst year since 2002. There's talk of restraints on their income. Also, there's some proposals out there for a special surcharge tax on Americans making over $1 million a year to help pay for this bailout. What would be fair to your mind?
Well, there's certainly some changes in the tax code that make sense to me. There's some complex rules that basically allow some of the very high income earners in the financial system to pay essentially no taxes, very low rates of taxes. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody understands that that should be gotten rid of. The lobbyists have been very strong. They're big contributors to all the campaigns, Democratic and Republican. And that there's some easy changes to make. You know, frankly, even tax simplification would go a long ways towards making it fairer. This tab for this is going to be a lot. I suspect it's going to end up costing more than $1 trillion for the taxpayer when we look back at this 5 or 6 years from now. That's a typical cost for what these big bailouts cost. That's 6 or 7% of our year's income.
James Galbraith, how should that tab be, you know, a portion, divvied up? Who should bear what here?
Well, I'm a little more optimistic than Ken. I think we don't know what these assets will be worth when the Treasury finally disposes of them. They are worth more than they're worth on the market because currently the market's in panic. The mortgages behind them, a lot of them have gone bad, but the vast majority are still being paid. So we'll see what the ultimate cost is. But let's suppose it's $500 billion, and so you're looking at, you know, a 10-year recoupment rate of $50 billion a year or something like that. Mm. I would have certainly no objection to a capital levy or a surcharge on the income tax for very high incomes that would cover that amount. In other words, that you would take this back from the people who, primarily from the people who are benefiting from it. That would seem to be a very reasonable way to go. You know, it's interesting something you said a minute ago about the top five independent Wall Street investment banks all having gone. It's only about 20 years since Ronald Reagan stood in Berlin and said, you know, tear down this wall. It's I think he would have been quite surprised to see that the next one to go was the one on Wall Street.
Wall Street. Let's go to Scott in Nashua, New Hampshire. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This touches upon what was just being discussed now. Henry Paulson was saying over the weekend that this is not a bailout in the savings and loan sense, but that the costs of this bailout will be recouped in the resale of the assets. But given the anticipated new regulatory structures, we don't know what they are yet, but given anticipated new regulatory structures mm-hmm. that probably will result in lower profits, I mean, how realistic is it to expect to recoup these losses in any significant way?
Ken Rogoff?
Well, I mean, I think it's not realistic. I think that we'll get something back from the mortgages. The problem is that it's not going to stop here. We have a much deeper problem in the financial system than just housing. It extends to commercial real estate. It extends to student loans, corporate credit, auto loans. And what I'm suggesting why the bill will end up being $1 trillion is when we throw in the political system together with these difficult problems, that's what these things end up costing. That's a typical estimate. If you look at other countries facing similar financial crises over the last 50 years, 6 or 7% of a year's income, that's, you know, about $1 trillion for us. That's a typical run-of-the-mill cost. That's not even bad. Japan
so you're saying when Hank Paulson says this will kind of pay for itself or a lot of it, you're not buying that?
Not at all. I think it's cleverly engineered, the little plan that he has.
To look like it might.
But it's not the whole picture. It's a step. We're going to see a lot more, and I'm bringing it all together. So his plan certainly won't cost more than $700 billion if they're asking for $700 billion. But it is not the end. We're going to do many other things before this is over.
Let's go to Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling to say that I think the bailout plan as proposed is a terrible idea. It fixes one problem, an insolvent financial system, and replaces it with a much worse problem, an insolvent country. As Ken Rogoff was just saying, this is not going to stop at $700 billion. This is, if you look at the statements coming out of the Treasury Department, for example, Paulson saying financial institutions must be allowed to fail. Let's be honest. A reasonable person has to conclude that the Treasury Secretary is lying. And I think that's the case for the cost of this thing. These assets are predicated on bubble prices in housing and credit bubbles. They're worth much less than what are on the banks of the books now. If you look at the numbers, it's multi-trillions of dollars, not $700 billion. This is going to, your next hour is about where people should put their money. Mm-hmm. It's going to be very difficult to make a case that you should have your money in anything that's dollar denominated, because this is, where is the money going to come to pay for this stuff? You have, collectively, Americans are very much in debt. This has got to come through taxes, but how can you raise taxes on people that are in debt, and you're using the money to bail out Wall Street firms?
Steve, we hear the fear, and who couldn't see the origin of it? Maybe more than fear, but really just a grim assessment there. James Galbraith, first, I mean, right now in Washington, the lobbyists are all over pricing these assets. How this money, this bailout money, will be used, and what portion of what they've got on the books will be covered by it. And going forward, our caller Steve says, look, it's not just an insolvent financial industry, it's an insolvent country we're dealing with.
The country, in my view, is not insolvent. Even if Ken is right, and he may well be, that the net cost of this is $1 trillion over 5 or 6 or 10 years or a decade, that can be absorbed by our economy, which is $15 trillion, without causing any great catastrophe. The dollar has not yet been affected by this, at least in the last few months. Actually, the dollar has been strengthening. The long-term interest rate faced by the federal government, 30-year bond, was under 4% last week. That tells you that the United States government is still a good credit in the world. The market in government bonds and bills is still very liquid. The rest of the world relies on the dollar as a reserve and a lubricant for world trade and finance. It may like, in principle, to go to some other system, but it's very difficult to make the transition. And so there will be a great reluctance to make that transition unless it becomes absolutely imperative. So there are a lot of reasons to believe that the basic position of the United States in the world economy can be rescued. I think, however, it's going to require a set of measures that will put our economy back on a path of growth, profitability in certain sectors, optimism and hope, ability to attract external investment that we have not been on since the late 1990s, and we're going to have to do that in a way that was more sustainable than it was in the late 1990s.
But how can that's a big challenge
for the next administration?
Well, how can that be done? I mean, Barack Obama has talked, for example, about big investments in infrastructure, but if this bailout is sucking up a lot of American government resources, doesn't it sort of cut into the agenda of any future president, McCain?
Real resources are being liberated freed up by the recession, by the collapse in housing. We've got lots of capacity in construction. It's directing that to repair our public infrastructure, federal, state, and local. It's directing that to reconfigure our uses and production of energy to deal with the problem of climate change. We've got work here that can fully employ the country for a generation if we organize it correctly and get started down that path. And I think if we do that, the rest of the world will finance it, and the dollar will not collapse. But it is going to require steps that go far beyond what's being put before the Congress this week.
Ken Rogoff, our caller, worries about an insolvent country. James Galbraith says, well, it's not as bad as all that. Look, we've still got a fair amount of liquidity and a global confidence in the dollar. He seems to maybe think there's a little more runway for recovery out there than you do. Your risk assessment seems to be a bit more dire.
Well, I share James's view that we can afford it. We are a $15 trillion economy. $1 trillion added to our debt still wouldn't bring it up to European levels relative to income. But $1 trillion is real money. I mean, you're talking about what the candidates would want to do in terms of health, education,
yes,
infrastructure, defense. This is huge, and it's being done so fast. It's a Christmas coming in September instead of November and December this year. It is a huge move. I do think there's a little more risk to the dollar than James said. I mean, I think that we're going to end up paying higher interest rates at the end of this, and we're going to see some dollar depreciation. The rest of the world is going to be a little less happy about holding so much U.S. assets.
Let's go to Jim in Newtown, Connecticut. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey, great conversation. Much of it's already answered some of the questions I had, but originally I was going to ask what your guests thought were what's the most criminal aspect of this
criminal aspect of what's transpired here? Like, somebody end up in the big house? Ken, first to you.
There's a lot of competition for that. I mean, there's
seriously, is there really? And like whom? For what?
No, I mean, I think that the first blame certainly lies with the political system, which egged on the housing sector and overinflated the housing sector, which is the bomb that underlies all of this and what was done with the big mortgage agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This year, certainly I've been deeply puzzled that some of the obscure, non-transparent markets, particularly the one called the credit default swap market, mm-hmm, which is now $62 trillion. Mm-hmm. And it grew hugely this year in the middle of the crisis. Why didn't we cut that off? Why didn't we stop that? Certainly there were a lot of mistakes made. But
that's
not
politics
sure
and policy, and our caller's asking about criminality.
Well, yeah. Let me put a word
James?
In here.
Okay.
In this administration, we had the director of the Office of Thrift Supervision come to a press conference with a stack of copies of the Federal Register and a chainsaw. They sent a very clear signal to the most rapacious and predatory and abusive elements of the financial sector that there would not be effective supervision. So they basically encouraged and abetted what was a massive amount of financial fraud, of mortgages made on the basis of inflated appraisals, inadequate or non-existent documentation. So there is there's direct criminality. In addition, the legislative process has abetted the abandonment of public responsibility. The credit default swaps market was legitimized by a law that was pushed into law in the dark of night in December of 2000, called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act by Senator Phil Graham, now a top advisor to Senator McCain. This was a set of legislative deeds which were not completely outside the normal congressional process, done at the behest of lobbies, and which opened the floodgates to the creation of these opaque and illiquid markets, which are now crashing down on us. So there's abuse and negligence, and there's also criminal malfeasance wrapped up in this in various places.
Let me get one more call here. Dennis in Kent, Connecticut. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to point out that in 2006, Henry Paulson was the CEO of Goldman Sachs, and in April of that year, Goldman Sachs was securitizing, packaging, and selling subprime mortgages. When these instruments started to tank, Goldman Sachs sold them short and made a killing. Paulson took millions in compensation, and it's more than ironic that Paulson, who is now our Secretary of Treasury, is attempting to paper over this systemic crisis, which he in part created, with $700 billion of taxpayer money.
It's a tough but important perspective right there, Dennis. Our time is short, but I appreciate it. Ken Rogoff, how about it? How do you feel about Hank Paulson at the center of this? On the one hand, he knows the system very well. On the other, he's a product of it. And you hear there from Dennis some recounting of the history of Goldman's own involvement in the subprime industry.
Well, they were playing by the rules that Congress made, and I think Paulson's come in and been pretty tough with the financial industry. They're not going around cheerleading him at the moment, believe me. I want to touch this point. This is very much a bipartisan problem. A lot of the underlying laws were put in place in the Clinton administration. That's when Frank Raines went to Fannie Mae and they were off to the races. He got $24 million in compensation and Fannie Mae took a lot of risk, good for the shareholders, bad for the taxpayer. And Congress, when it's been under Democratic leadership, has resisted any reform of these organizations.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac,
who lie at the heart of the problem of they took over the home loan market, and they're really, I think, the ones who created this pressure on housing more than anything else.
James Galbraith, what about the party aspect of this?
I think much of what happened in home lending occurred outside of Fannie Mae through the subprime channels. And that's what is the immediate cause of this disaster. But let me say about Paulson, I think the picture is mixed. Based on his record, I would borrow a phrase from Ronald Reagan, trust but verify. And that is what Congress has to do. They cannot give him a blank check. On the other hand, he is the guy on the job, and he is showing every sign of intent to do that job. But I wouldn't turn my back and let him do it without oversight and supervision.
Well, we will be watching closely in these next days as Congress wades in to a rescue that they're being urged to do very, very quickly. We're very grateful to each of you for sharing your perspective with us today. James Galbraith in Austin, Texas at the University of Texas at Austin, author of the new book, The Predator's State. James Galbraith, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Kenneth Rogoff, professor of economics at Harvard University, thank you so much for your insights. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rowley, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Will Roselip. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.